we want to thank Anthony and the Asian American and Asian Research Institute for inviting us to speak tonight. We want to thank all of you for joining us, because we know that in New York City there are plenty of other options for you, especially on a Friday evening. So we're glad that you've chosen to spend part of your Friday night with us. So Fred Korematsu Speaks Up is a biography of Fred Korematsu, a civil rights activist, and we're going to tell you much more about him in our presentation. We wrote the book for kids. We initially intended it for fourth and fifth grade students, but since the book has been published, it was published in January of 2017. It was released on January 30th, which is Fred Korematsu's birthday. So since then, about a year and a half ago, we have spoken to more than 7,000 students, mainly on the West Coast, and at more than 50 schools. And this is our first trip outside of the West Coast to speak about the book and Fred Korematsu's life. So we're really delighted to be here in New York City, and we've so far spoken at three different schools, two here in Manhattan and one in Hastings on Hudson, and we'll be speaking on Monday at Bank Street School here in the city as well. We're going to share with you tonight a version of the presentation that we have shared with the 7,000 students. And it's interactive, so we hope that you will respond to some of the questions that we are going to be asking you. And we'll begin first with a question. Any of you have a guess who this is?
Does he do karate?
No. Any other guesses?
It's not Fred.
It's not Fred Korematsu. Good guess, though. Usually that's a kid's first guess.
Does he have a grandson?
No.
Okay.
I feel like I'm in a game show. What's my line?
Is that you?
That's me.
Yay!
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yay, you win the prize.
The car.
How did you guess that was me, or was it deduction?
It was the hair.
Okay. I still have fairly good hair. So this is me when I was 10 years old. And I explained to the kids that when I was 10, like many of the students to whom we're speaking, I loved to play basketball. And I was learning to play tennis, and usually there are kids in the audience who like to play basketball as well and play tennis. And I was taking piano lessons, and I still play the piano. And what I loved to do when I was 10 was to roller skate. And my career ambition when I was 10 was to become a roller derby star. So you can imagine my parents were thrilled with that goal. But I explained to the kids that when I was 10, I also learned something very unusual that happened to my family, and I asked them, you know, why is this woman dressed like that? And obviously, she is graduating. And this is a photo of my mother, and it's from her high school graduation. And I tell the students that my mother didn't graduate from any regular high school like they will eventually graduate from, but that my mother graduated from a high school that was in a prison camp in the California desert. And I asked them, why do you think my mother was put into a prison camp when she was 15 years old? And usually there's one history buff student in the audience who raises her hand and says, oh, it's because the United States was at war with Japan. And then I usually further elaborate that, yes, because the U.S. was at war with Japan, the U.S. government feared that all people of Japanese ancestry, including my mother, who was born in Salt Lake City, and Fred, who was born in Oakland, and their parents, immigrant parents, who were not allowed to become American citizens at that point, the government lumped them all together and feared that they would commit acts of espionage, that they were spies for Japan, and so forced them from their homes in the West Coast into these prison camps. And my mother was in a camp called Manzanar, which was in the desert in the eastern part of California. So I tell kids that my connection to Fred Korematsu's story is that my mother, my father, my grandparents, my uncles and aunts were all put into these camps, just like Fred and his family.
And I explain that I have a different connection to getting to help Stan, so we wrote the book together, tell Fred's story. So I grew up in a family of activists, and sometimes we'll ask the kids, or, you know, what's an activist, or say, you know, people who speak up for what they believe in and take action. So this man here with the glasses is my father, and that's him in the late 60s in San Francisco at an anti-Vietnam War protest at Kezar Stadium. And on the right side is my mother and her now wife, Jan. And they met actually through a political singing group. So they use music and song as a way to protest. And this is them at a women's rights event. So I became a young activist myself. Oop, this one's missing a picture of me as a seventh grader. When I was in middle school at Martin Luther King Junior High School in Berkeley, the issue that we were really worried about at that time was the development of nuclear weapons, which many of you probably remember. The day after was a big event when we watched the movie, and I explained that there were times when I couldn't sleep at night because I was worried about whether I was going to wake up in the morning or not. And so when I was in the seventh grade, we decided at my school to come together and form an anti-nuclear group and meet and talk about what we could do about it. And the picture on the right is when I was at Berkeley High School, and we continued to meet and talk about what we could do, and this was a demonstration at Lawrence Livermore Labs, which was a place where they were developing nuclear weapons. And we blockaded, so we sat across the road to stop people from coming to work, and the police are there facing us, and we got arrested. And the second paragraph here, you know, says the demonstration resulted in the arrests of 65 protesters, 10 of whom were Berkeley High School students. So I explained that one thing I learned from that is that when you're a young person and you speak up, sometimes adults will pay attention and you might make a difference. So for me, getting to help tell Fred Korematsu's story as a very important civil rights and hero has been really meaningful. So then we introduce the book, the way that we put it together in the format. So we decided to tell the story in a few different ways, and one is that we sort of separated out Fred Korematsu's biography into sort of free verse poems to help readers really empathize with his experience. So I'm going to read you the first poem in the book, and this is called Getting a Haircut. Fred's hair needs cutting. His friends have the snazziest styles, short and sharp, slicked down and combed back. All the rage. Up until now, Fred's mother has cut his hair. Straight, simple. Fred wants to get his hair cut by a real barber. He walks into his local barber shop. The waxy smell of pomade oil mingles with the sound of snipping scissors. "Hey, boy, what do you want?" the barber says. "I just want to get a haircut," Fred tells him. "We don't cut hair of your kind." "Why?" "Because Fred's parents are from Japan. The barbershop won't serve people who look like Fred." Fred knows this isn't fair. He has as much right to that haircut as any of his friends. Fred walks out past other barbershops that will not cut his hair and restaurants that will not serve him food. He goes to Oakland's Chinatown, where people who look like Fred are welcome. He gets his hair cut in the latest style, just like his friends.
So in addition to conveying Fred Korematsu's life story in our book, we also provide background information so that kids can understand what was happening in the world, in the U.S., and specifically on the West Coast during his life. And so this is one of those background sections. It's the one that accompanies the poem that Laura just read. And this section covers discrimination against different groups throughout U.S. history. So I asked the kids how many of them are of Irish ancestry, and usually there's at least a handful who are of Irish descent. And so I point out the illustration in the upper left, which depicts Irish immigrants about 150 years ago as monsters. And I tell the kids that at that time, Americans felt that Irish immigrants were lazy and dangerous and didn't want them coming to the U.S. Then I ask if any of the students identify as Chinese American, and especially in California and in the Bay Area, there are several. And so I point out at the same time, about 150 years ago, there were people from all over the world who were converging in California because of the gold rush, including immigrants from China, but that they were unwelcome, and that illustration in the lower left shows a white miner attacking a Chinese immigrant. And I tell them about the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred virtually all immigration from China for 60 years until World War II. So they were also the unwanted immigrants of that time. Then we look at that photo on the lower right of the screen, and I ask if any of the kids identify as Latino, Latinx. And again, in California, oftentimes several students do. And so that sign, which was of that photo, which was taken of a sign in a business in Texas that says, "We serve whites only, no Spanish or Mexicans," was taken, I believe, in the late 50s or early 60s, so not, relatively speaking, that long ago. And I explained that if you were Latino, you wouldn't have been served in that restaurant, just like Fred was not given that haircut that Laura just read about. And then we focus on the photo in the upper right of the segregated drinking fountains. And usually by the time we're the age of the students to whom we're speaking, so 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, students understand about the history, at least fundamentally, about the history of segregation in the South. But I point out, especially when we're speaking California, that that kind of legalized segregation was not just limited to southern states. That in San Francisco, for example, there were segregated schools for African-American children, for white children, and for Asian children at different times. African-Americans were often forced off of streetcars in San Francisco in the 19th century. So it wasn't just something that we, in our popular imagination, think happened in the South. This is a painting that we have reproduced in our book, and some of you may know the artist. And this was made prior to World War II, and it depicts a Japanese-American farm family. And I point out that Japs, the sign in the back says, "No Japs Wanted," and you know, kids these days may not know what that means, and so I explain that it's a bad way of referring to Japanese people or Japanese-Americans. And I explained that not only was it because of racism that this family is being forced out of their community, you can see their belongings in the cart, but also because Japanese-American farmers on the West Coast were very successful, are oftentimes very successful, and white farmers didn't want to have the competition from the Japanese-American farmers. So that was another reason to try to eject Japanese-Americans from different communities. And this particular painting is very meaningful to me because my paternal grandfather, who is pictured here as a young man, was a farmer in California. First in the Imperial Valley, if you know where that is, it's sort of east, southeast of San Diego, and then in the Central Valley. But before that, he first immigrated from Okinawa, the southern part of Japan, to Hawaii and worked in the sugarcane plantations there for a while, and then really wanted to come to or go to California to be a farmer. But at that time, the gentleman's agreement was in place, which some of you may know was an agreement between the U.S. government and the Japanese government. And the Japanese government agreed to bar Japanese laborers from going to the West Coast. So technically, my grandfather was not supposed to go to California. So my grandmother told me in a very kind of, she was very ashamed of this when she told me this, that my grandfather told immigration officials that he was Filipino. Because, as you might know, the Philippines was a colony of the U.S. at that time, and so there was no ban on Filipinos coming to California. And obviously, the immigration officials didn't look at his papers that closely. I don't know how he was able to get away with that, but he was. And so my own grandfather arrived on the west coast of our country in a way that today we would consider him an undocumented immigrant.
So getting...
So it would have been after 1907, because that's when the gentleman's agreement went into effect.
So getting back to Fred Korematsu's story. So Fred was born in Oakland, as Stan said, and raised there. That's Fred Korematsu standing in front of his parents. He was one of four brothers, and the family ran a flower nursery near the Oakland-San Leandro border, which is in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area. And they grew mainly carnations and roses and sold them to flower shops around the Bay Area. And Fred's parents came from Japan, and they felt very proud of their Japanese culture, and that was something they wanted their children to feel as well. They brought in tutors to teach them Japanese. They took them to the Buddhist temple. They celebrated Japanese holidays. But Fred, in particular, sort of rebelled against that and wasn't interested in it. He hadn't been to Japan. He didn't really relate to it. He mostly liked to be in the Boy Scouts and listen to music and hang out with his friends. He played tennis. So that was a point of tension in the family. He was often seen as the sort of least well-behaving child. He got in trouble. He and his friends stole oranges off of a neighbor's tree. But also when he went to Castlemont High School in Oakland, he learned about the U.S. Constitution. So he learned about the rights that he should have as a United States citizen.
So Fred Korematsu was 23 years old when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And we usually have to go into a little bit of the history with the kids we speak to because when you're in the fourth grade, you probably don't have a good sense of World War II history. By the eighth grade, sometimes students do. So we explain that the Japanese military attacked the U.S. military base in Pearl Harbor. You know, thousands of soldiers and sailors, U.S. soldiers and sailors died, and hundreds of U.S. military warships and planes were destroyed. And every Sunday morning, Fred Korematsu and his girlfriend at that time, an Italian-American woman named Ida Boitano, would drive into the Oakland Hills in Fred's new Pontiac. He was very proud of having bought that car with money he earned from working as a welder. So they'd drive in his new Pontiac into the Oakland Hills overlooking the San Francisco Bay. They would turn on the car radio and listen to music, and they would read the comics in the Sunday paper. So on this particular Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, the music program they were listening to was interrupted by the news of the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. And Fred and Ida looked at each other, and they were shocked and scared. They didn't know what was going to happen. So Fred drove Ida home. He returned to his own home, where he found his parents and brothers around the radio. So his parents are depicted on the right there in the illustration, listening to this news. And since his parents were not allowed to become U.S. citizens, they couldn't naturalize at that point, they were now technically citizens of an enemy nation. So it was unclear what was going to happen to them. And about 2 months after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, which, as you probably know, authorized the military to designate parts of the U.S. from which anybody could be excluded. And soon thereafter, the military commander on the West Coast designated the western parts of Washington, Oregon, and California, and the southern part of Arizona totally off limits for all people of Japanese ancestry, regardless of whether they were American citizens or not. And then soon after that, the government instituted this program of forcing Japanese Americans into camps. So we explain that oftentimes Japanese Americans only had a matter of a few days to take care of their businesses if they had businesses, to figure out what to do with property. Oftentimes they had to sell that at pennies to the dollar of the value of that property, figure out where to store property if they were going to store property. And so there are a lot of important decisions to make within a short period of time. And I tell the students that people could only take what they could carry in two hands, and there were no roller bags in that era, right? So they had to physically be able to lift their bags. And so I asked them, if you only had 5 days and you weren't quite sure if you were ever going to return, in this case to New York City, if you had to leave your home, you weren't quite sure where the government was going to force you to live, and you could only take what you could carry in two bags, what would you take with you? And you only had 5 days to decide. And so these days, a lot of times kids will say, oh, I take my cell phone, I would take my
PS
game,
something.
Whatever, we don't know the letters and numbers to use, but they're gaming systems. But, you know, oftentimes they'll say we'll take clothes and food and first aid kits. Came up a lot today when we spoke to kids. So a lot of, you know, thoughtful answers to this. And I explained to them that if cell phones existed at that time, they would not have been allowed to take them. I asked them, why do you think you couldn't take your cell phone if they existed at that point? And some kids will say, oh, it's because, you know, if the government feared that Japanese Americans were spies, that they could, you know, communicate to others, which is actually a kind of smart answer. But the other reason, or real reason, is because you could take pictures on your phone, right? And the government didn't want the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated to be taking pictures. And even though we're going to be seeing pictures of the camps that Japanese Americans were forced to live in, those were taken by government officials who were documenting, including Dorothea Lange, who was hired by the government to take photos, and Ansel Adams
this
as well.
Picture.
So I also asked the kids if they have pets, and usually at least half of the students in the audience will raise their hand. And I explained that you wouldn't have been able to take your dog or your cat or your parrot or your hamster to camp. And so usually that's like, whoa, what am I mean? And I asked them, if you only had 5 days to figure out what to do with your dog or your cat, what would you do? And sometimes, like a smart-alecky kid will say, I would eat it.
Yeah, we've had that a few times.
We've had that come up a few times.
Or kill it, which actually did happen. People euthanized their pets.
Yeah. And people would, or students will often say, oh, I would give it to a relative. But then I explain, well, if your relative was Japanese-American, they couldn't take it either, right? Or would take it to a shelter or whatever. But these kinds of questions really help to concretize for the kids that even kids of their age and younger would have important decisions to make within a relatively short period of time. We point out that this number, 21538, was the Korematsu family number, and that each family was assigned a number, and they had to write their family number and their names on the tags, which are on the bags in the photo to the right. And this little girl from Oakland, in this photo by Dorothea Lange, was forced to leave her home. And I point out that she has a tag on her blouse, like she's a piece of property as opposed to a human being.
So when Fred Korematsu heard that he was supposed to go to these prison camps along with his family, his first reaction was, why do I have to go to prison? I haven't done anything wrong. And he and Ida had talked about getting married, and I explained that they could not legally have gotten married in California at that time because she was white and he was Japanese American. So he came up with a plan. There was a short window when people could leave the West Coast, though it was difficult to leave. It's interesting in our going and speaking to people, we've heard lots of stories, and one librarian told us about, was it her father leaving, and how they weren't allowed on the highways. You know, so all these restrictions, and then they went and stayed at a gas station, I think, and then they were threatened, you know. So I think for a lot of people, things, why didn't people just leave? Or, you know, and when you start to hear the real stories, it really, you understand it differently. So he came up with a plan that he and Ida would leave and get married, but he was waiting for her she was agreeable, but, you know, to come on board and for them to go. So in the meantime, he moved out of his parents' house. He moved into a bedsit in Oakland, and he told people his name was Clyde Sarah, and he said that he was Spanish Hawaiian. And I explained that people, you know, can't necessarily tell what your background is by looking at you. So he, for a while, said afterwards that he felt sort of strangely free during that time. He would take the bus. He and Ida would go on dates to the movies together. But then one day he saw the headlines that his family and everybody else in the Japanese American community in the Bay Area had been sent to one of these camps. And he said later it was like getting punched in the stomach when he saw it. And then soon after that, he got arrested, and we don't know, but somebody must have identified him as being Japanese American. So he was in jail. And so I'm going to read to you the next part of the book, and this is called Saying Yes. Jail becomes Fred's new home. He sleeps on a hard bed, trapped behind bars. Fred thinks that Ida must be worried. He didn't have a chance to talk to her when he got caught. One day a guard says, "You got a visitor." Fred is taken to a meeting room. A young man in a gray suit shakes Fred's hand and introduces himself as Ernest Bessig, a lawyer. "I would like to help you," he says. Fred can't afford a lawyer, but Ernest says he will not charge any money. He works for the American Civil Liberties Union and read about Fred in the newspapers. He hopes that Fred will fight the case against him, which will also mean challenging the imprisonment of all Japanese Americans as unconstitutional. Ernest tells Fred that the fight could take a long time, with little chance of winning, because there is so much discrimination against people who look like Fred. Is he willing? Fred thinks about it. He doesn't want to go to the prison camp. But more than that, he knows that what the government is doing is not fair. He decides to fight. Fred says yes.
So we then explained to students that after Ernest Bessig from the ACLU visited Fred in jail, Fred was transferred from the San Leandro jail to the camp at Tanforan, which is where his parents and all the Japanese Americans from the San Francisco Bay Area were forced to live initially. So Tanforan, as you may know, was a racetrack south of San Francisco. And it quickly got converted into what was then called an assembly center, you know, by the government. So there were about 15 of these assembly centers along the West Coast, close to the communities in which Japanese Americans were living. So all Japanese Americans in the San Francisco Bay Area had to go initially to Tanforan. And we explained to the students that when they first arrived, one of the things they had to do was to stuff these white sacks with hay, and those were people's beds. This drawing in the upper left was done by Mineo Kubo, who used to live here in New York City and who I met about 30-something years ago and interviewed her when I was a student. So she was at Tanforan as well. And before she arrived at Tanforan, there were no partitions between the toilets. And so I explained to the kids that people would have to go to the bathroom standing or sitting next to strangers without any privacy at all. And usually they're slack-jawed when they hear that. And they're not, you know, they're they're kind of horrified by the illustration as well. And you can see that even though there are now partitions in the latrine, one of the women has a blanket in front of her, another one has a half door, and they're obviously, you know, not happy and ashamed about using such primitive bathroom facilities. So now we're going to see and hear Fred Korematsu as an older man,
hopefully,
describe what it was like when he arrived at Tanferi.
When the MPs took me to a separate room, well, it was a horse stall, and it was way out on the other side of the racetrack, and they took me there in a pickup. But it was a big door for the lent horses in. There's a gap about 12 inches down below. There's no floor, it's just dirt, so the wind was blowing through there, and there's cracks all around the walls, and there's a light bulb up there, one light bulb on the ceiling, and that was it. And I went there and I lied on the cot and I said, gee, jail was a lot better than this.
So after Fred first went to the room that was a horse stall, he then got moved into the barrack with his parents and his brothers. So they were all in one room in barracks. And I explained to the kids that Fred's parents knew he had been arrested, and they knew that he had agreed to have his case challenged, putting all Japanese Americans into these prison camps. And that was ultimately 120,000 people who were in these camps. And I explained that that included babies and children and old people, that the government went into orphanages and took children and babies out. They went into old people's homes and took old people, and that none of them had done anything wrong. And I sometimes will ask kids, how do you think Fred's parents felt about this, that he was doing this? And sometimes they'll say, well, scared, that's a big thing to stand up against the government, or proud. And I say, well, actually, his father was very angry at him, and his mother felt ashamed. And she said she was too embarrassed to even leave the barracks and be seen by other people. And I say it's important to remember that it was a time of war and that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor, and people on the West Coast were afraid that they were going to get bombed too. And that within the Japanese American community, the majority of people decided to show loyalty. So that, including the leaders within the Japanese American community, that the popular position to take was to go along. And so that with Fred Korematsu fighting it, he was not supported by most of the people around him, his parents, his brothers. Ida Boitano, his girlfriend, broke up with him very soon after he went to Tanferi. This illustration, which is done by Yutaka Hulett, the illustrator of our book, is set at Topaz. So Fred and his family and most of the people from Tanferi were transferred to a prison camp in the Utah desert called Topaz. And I point out that he's put the scorpion there and the dust and the wind coming through the window to show that we're at Topaz. And you can see there that people don't want to sit with him. People would say, oh, he thinks he's more white than Japanese. And sometimes people had jobs at the camps, and he would work at night instead of during the day so that he would avoid being around people. And so I explained that it took a lot of courage for Fred to keep fighting his case, because at any point along the way, he could have said, I don't want to do this anymore, it's too hard. But he didn't, because he knew that he was fighting for something that was right. So even though in the beginning he went to jail because, you know, he wanted to be with his girlfriend, over time it really became a principled stance and not a popular one.
So even though Fred's parents, his brothers, and most Japanese Americans at first in Tanferi and then at Topaz didn't support his decision to take his case, which went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually, he still had a friend in Ernest Besick, the ACLU attorney, and they wrote letters to one another, which are now collected at the California Historical Society in San Francisco. And this is a copy of a letter that we have reproduced in our book, in which Fred is describing to Ernest Besick what it's like to live at Topaz. And he's saying to Ernest Besick, just a little wind and the dust rises like fog all over the relocation center. You can't see 10 feet in front of you because of all the dust. We all have to wear masks made of cloth because they don't want to breathe in the dust. So I explained to the kids, you can just imagine how unhealthy and how unpleasant it was to live in Topaz. And my mother recounted similar stories of living in Manzanar and the dust storms in Manzanar. So Fred's case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and explained to the students that this is the most powerful court in our country. And Fred really believed that the justices would see how wrong and unjust it was to imprison ultimately about 120,000 Japanese Americans who had not done anything wrong. So he was surprised and shocked and disappointed when he received a letter from Ernest Besig telling him that six of the nine justices basically said it was okay for the U.S. government to imprison innocent Japanese Americans on the contention that there was a quote-unquote military necessity, which in today's language would translate into national security reasons to do so. So there were three dissenters. Robert Jackson said that the decision, the majority decision, was like a loaded gun that was waiting for any future politician to pull the trigger who could claim that there was a national security reason to lock up a whole group of people. Another judge called it racist, but obviously six is more than three, so the majority ruled against Fred, and he lived with that disappointment for decades. Oops.
That's the letter.
I forgot we had included this. So this is a copy of a letter that Fred sent to Ernest Besig upon hearing the news. And I think it's really so telling. About Fred Korematsu's spirit. So I want to read it. Dear Mr. Besig, I have received your letter and read the news of my case. What happened in Supreme Court is a great disappointment. I know everything possible was done in fighting the case. Even though we lost, I can't express my appreciation of thanks for all the fighting the ACLU and you have done for me. Will you please give my thanks and regards to Mr. Collins? This is Wayne Collins, an attorney who was handling a lot of the day-to-day aspects of Fred's case. Then he pivots and says, congratulations on hearing you having a new baby daughter. I'm very glad to hear that news. I bet you're happy. So here Fred has received, you know, some of the most devastating news he's ever going to receive in his life. And he turns around and congratulates Ms. Besig.
So I then say that the war ended and the governments closed the camps and said to people, you can go, but a lot of people didn't have homes to go back to. Fred's family were lucky that they found tenants to rent their flower nursery, so they were able to return to that, but it was in terrible condition, so they had to repair it and fix it up. I say that kids would have to go to school after having been in a prison camp, in some cases, for years. But Fred had an additional challenge. Because he lost in the Supreme Court, he had a criminal conviction. And so there were certain jobs that he couldn't get. He couldn't work for the government. He couldn't work for big corporations. He trained to become a realtor, and he passed the test. But then when he went to go get his license, he was told, you can't be a realtor because of your criminal conviction. So he had to put together lots of jobs just to make ends meet. He moved to Detroit initially and met and married his wife, Catherine, who's in this photograph. And I explained that even still, it would have been illegal for them at that time to get married in California. They eventually moved back to the Oakland, San Leandro, which is near Oakland, the Bay Area, and they had their two kids, Karen and Ken. So now we're going to fast forward, and Karen's a junior in high school, and her friend Maya is giving a presentation on what she calls the American concentration camps. And she mentions this court case, Korematsu versus the United States. And everybody looks at Karen because they know that's her last name. And she looks back and is like, what? Because she's never heard of the case. But not only that, she's never heard of the camps because they didn't talk about it as a family. And that was quite common, that people didn't talk about it. There was a lot of shame around having been put in these prison camps. So she went home and she said to her mom, Mom, who is this Korematsu? Is this like a distant relative? And her mom said, no, it was your father. And you can talk to him about it when he gets home. So she waited. He worked late. So when he got home, she asked him about it. And he said to her, it happened a long time ago. I was right, but I lost. And she said she could tell it was so painful for him to tell even just that little bit that she couldn't ask him any more questions. And then 4 years later, the same thing happened with her brother, Ken. He learned about it at school. And if you see Karen Korematsu speak, or you can listen to the More Perfect podcast, which basically tells this story. And she tells that story with still a lot of feeling.
So we're going to fast forward again now 15 years after Karen first found out about her father's case and the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And so now Fred is in his 60s, and he's depicted here on the left. And he gets a call out of the blue from the man depicted on the right named Peter Irons, who at that point was a professor of political science at UC San Diego. And Peter Irons was doing research for a book. He was writing about Fred Korematsu's case and the cases of Gordon Hirabayashi and Minya Sui, two other Japanese-American men who challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court curfew orders and then the mass exclusion of Japanese-Americans. And Peter Irons discovered at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., documents that showed that the U.S. government had basically lied to the Supreme Court and suppressed evidence of Japanese-American loyalty, obviously to skew the decision. And this is one of the documents that Peter Irons discovered. This was a memo written by a Department of Justice attorney who was actually trying to do the right thing and was arguing that the government had to reveal to the court that information that they were sharing was inaccurate. And one of the things that the government argued was that Japanese-Americans on the West Coast were sending signals to Japanese enemy ships in the Pacific Ocean. And the government knew that this was not true at all. It was, had been proven otherwise by both the FCC and I believe it was the FCC, whatever government entity that regulates radio communications, and also the FBI. And there are other things that the government did as well, which we won't get into detail right now. So this memo is referring to those accusations of ship-to-shore or shore-to-ship signaling. So since this, those accusations, is not so, it is highly unfair to this racial minority, Japanese Americans, that these lies put out in an official publication go uncorrected. So obviously this attorney was overruled by his superiors and the Supreme Court was basically lied to. So when Fred Korematsu found out this news from Peter Irons, he was shocked and angry, because he knew that if the Supreme Court knew the truth, he might have won his case. So Fred turned to Peter Irons and said, "Are you an attorney?" And Peter Irons said, "Yes." And Fred said, "Will you be my attorney?" Because he wanted to reopen his case and challenge his criminal conviction. And Peter Irons said, yes, he would help him. And to Peter Irons' credit, he recruited, so this is Peter Irons on the right at the bottom, and then Fred in the middle. So Peter Irons helped to recruit a team of young Japanese-American attorneys who worked pro bono to represent Fred Korematsu in reopening his criminal conviction. And there, the Japanese-American attorneys' parents and grandparents, like mine, had been incarcerated during World War II, so they had some skin in the game trying to right this wrong. And some of you in the audience may know some of these attorneys. So Dale Minami is here on the lower left. He is now a very well-recognized and respected civil rights attorney in San Francisco. Right behind him is Don Tamaki, which I know one of you knows, who is in law practice with Dale Minami. Next to Don Tamaki, in the middle, right behind Fred, is Dennis Hayashi, who is now Superior Court Judge in Alameda County in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then behind Peter Irons is Lorraine Van Nuy, who is now a professor of law at Seattle University. And she's also author of a biography of Fred Korematsu called Enduring Conviction. And we want to do a shout-out to Lorraine because she was very generous with us when we were doing our research. So she gave us a manuscript of her book, of her book before it was published. And she shared her primary source documents with us as well, including interviews that she had done with some of Fred's associates and friends, as well as FBI files that she had recovered from Fred's history.
And she's the director of the...
Yes, so she's the director of the Fred Korematsu Center for Civil Liberties
in the Constitution.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you're in the audience. Mm-hmm. And that's at Seattle University, where she teaches law. And they file amicus briefs currently in support of Muslim and Arab and South Asian Americans who are being targeted. They do research on legal cases related to civil rights. And this is a picture of Fred with Minya Sui in the middle and Gordon Hirabayashi on the left, after they all filed cases to reopen their criminal conviction decisions. And the legal theory that the teams that represented these men used was a very obscure, little used writ called a writ of quorum nobis. And it can only be used in situations where someone has been convicted, has served their time or been punished, and there's documentation that there was some official wrongdoing that took place. So they were all able to reopen their cases based on that writ of error, quorum nobis theory, legal theory.
And they made the decision not to try. I don't even know if they could have, because this gets quite technical, which was a tricky thing for us in a book for fourth, fifth graders, right? But they didn't appeal at the Supreme Court level. So one of the things that comes up is that they were really overturning his conviction.
Right, not the Supreme Court case. So neither of us are lawyers, so we can't get into the nitty-gritty of...
Yeah. Someone else could probably do better than we can.
Right.
Luckily, we can kind of do it at a seventh
grade level.
So the day came and the...
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, more.
Yeah, there's more. Wait, there's more. So we explained that Fred reopening his case was not only important to him personally, but that it was important to the Japanese-American community, because at this time in the early 1980s, the Japanese-American community was organizing for redress and reparations. So they were lobbying Congress for a formal governmental apology to Japanese-Americans who had been incarcerated, and also monetary redress of $20,000 for each person who was incarcerated and still living at that time. And there was all, you know, a lot of community debate, and we don't need to go into that right now. But Japanese Americans who were lobbying members of Congress were hearing from a lot of congressional representatives, well, why should we pass this legislation? Because the Supreme Court said this is okay to do. So if Fred and Gordon and Min had lost their cases again, it really would have set back the redress movement. And we include this picture at the bottom right, and I'm sure most of you in the audience recognize Bill and Yuri Kochiyama, because they're well-known, world-renowned civil rights activists, but also because in this particular context, they were leaders of the redress movement here in New York City. And I just want to do a personal shout-out to Bill and Yuri, because they were sort of mentors of mine when I was in college, and I would stay with them in their apartment in Harlem in the early 80s when I was a college student, so they're very near and dear to my heart.
And we spoke at the Manhattan Country School 2 days ago, I think, and their granddaughter, Akemi, works there and brought us there and was wonderful. And she told us that Columbia has acquired the archive of their materials. So,
oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So that might be, maybe that's not public.
Oh, I hope it is. Well, she didn't say not to say. And she said her...
So keep it amongst ourselves.
Right, I guess so. But she said her grandmother kept a journal every day of her life from when she was like 15.
Oh,
so there's a lot there. There's boxes and
treasure
boxes.
Trove.
Yeah. Okay, so now the day comes when the federal court in San Francisco, the judge, Justice Marilyn Patel, is going to make her decision. And people lined up from early in the morning to get in. They sat, and you can see in the picture, the seats were full. People were sitting in the jury boxes. And many of these were people who 40 years earlier had been in the camps with Fred, and they hadn't supported him at that time. But now they were really on his side and hoping that his conviction would be overturned. So Judge Patel invited him to stand up and address the court before she gave her decision, and he gave a very moving speech, and this is part of what he said. As long as my record stands in federal court, any American citizen can be held in prison or concentration camp without a trial or hearing. That is, if they look like the enemy of this country. Therefore, I would like to see the government admit that they were wrong and do something about it. So this will never happen again to any American citizen of any race, creed, or color. Which is a very topical thing to say right now. So he sat down, and Judge Patel gave her ruling, and it was quite technical. So he turned to Dale Menami, his lawyer, and he said, "What did she say?" And Dale said, "Fred, you won. You won your case." And all these people came down, and they were shaking his hand, and they were hugging him. And now they really saw him as a hero for having stood up for 40 years for what he believed in and what was right.
And so after Fred's criminal conviction was overturned, he spent the rest of his life speaking around the country, telling people about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, about his case, about how the government had lied, and how he reopened his case. And in 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded Fred the Presidential Medal of Freedom, comparing him to Rosa Parks, another great civil rights hero. And the medal is around his neck there. And I explained to the kids that this is the highest civilian honor in the United States. So after September 11th, Fred was one of the first people to speak out publicly in support of Muslim, South Asian, Middle Eastern immigrants and citizens who were being unfairly targeted just because of the way they looked and what they believed religiously, just like Japanese Americans were targeted after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And Fred lent his name to an amicus brief that went to the U.S. Supreme Court supporting the argument of Muslim men who were being indefinitely detained without trials or charges even. So this was taken at NYU Law School, so not too far from here. And I explained that Fred loved speaking to students. And one of those students was me. In 1983, Fred, so soon after his criminal conviction was overturned, he came to speak at UCLA where I was an undergraduate. And I think that was the first time I had heard his story. And I was really impressed, not just with his story, but with him as a person, because he could have been like one of my uncles. You know, he just like looked like one of my, maybe one of my uncles. And as you could probably, maybe some of you have met him. I don't know if you ever met him or heard him speak. So those of you who have met him know he wasn't a tall man. He wasn't big. He didn't have a loud personality or, you know, loud voice. And I'm not tall or big, or usually I'm not very loud. But Fred really taught me that if I stood up for what I believe in and speak out against what I think is wrong, I could really make a difference in the world. And so ever since then, more than 30 years ago, Fred has been one of my heroes.
And we talk about how kids may have noticed a lot of people are speaking out these days. This has actually been a sort of a changing array of pictures of slides of people speaking out. But so that's Stan and his husband David at the Women's March in Los Angeles. That's me and my fifth grade daughter Cassie, who's actually here with me in town right now. And that's at a rally against hate that took place in Berkeley. And I was very proud of her. She came up with that sign, Black Lives Matter Makes America Gladder. That was pretty good. young people protesting as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, young people defending the rights of immigrants and dreamers, and then just recently, young people being real leaders in protests around gun violence and gun control. But so protest is one way that people can speak out. They can do what Fred Korematsu did and use the courts or publicly speak. But there's lots of different ways. So my mother and her wife still use music. They're part of the La Peña Community Chorus in Berkeley, so they go to protests. But they also went to Cuba as part of a cultural exchange. I sometimes will ask kids, how many of you are artists? And, of course, many of them raise their hands and say, you know, we included artwork in the book. So the picture of the farm family in the bathrooms, those were people who were using art as a way of speaking up. And for me and Stan, what we do is we've written this book and we're going around and talking to students. So for each of us, you know, we can figure out who we are and what makes sense to find ways to speak up for what we believe in.
And so, as I explained at the very beginning of our presentation, we have spoken to more than 7,000 students, mainly on the West Coast, but now here in New York. And we are going to be returning to New York in October, mid-October, because Fred Korematsu speaks up, in addition to being awarded the New York Historical Society's Children's Book Prize, was named an honor book by the Jane Addams Peace Association. And their book awards ceremony is going to be in mid-October, so we'll be coming out for that. And we'd be happy to speak at any schools if any of you have kids or grandkids or other children in your lives that, you know, would benefit from hearing about Fred Korematsu's story.
What else do we have here? And in speaking to schools, one of the things that's been such a privilege for me and Stan, especially in this time period, I mean, the book came out January 30th of 2017, which, as we'll all remember, was quite a fraught moment, and we spoke at the first school that was named for Fred Korematsu in Davis, California, and afterwards we had these three fifth grade girls come up to us, and we have this picture, which we'll get to you, how can you be like Fred and speak up for what you believe, or what you think is right. And these girls came up to us, big smiles on their face, and they wanted to tell us what they had done. And they told us that their mosque in Davis had been vandalized, and they worked with their school community to raise money to help to repair it. And they came with their teacher, who was clearly, you know, very proud. And, you know, it was such a horrible thing to hear that had happened. But to see, you know, that they had felt empowered enough to do that and supported by their school community, that was a very powerful moment for us. And I think, yeah, we went to, this is Lisa Bishop, who's a middle school librarian in San Francisco. And she told us about some of the great things she's doing with her kids. So she has these typewriters that she keeps in the library, and she gets the kids to write letters. I know, a typewriter, yes.
Right, really.
So before the election, she said she was having the kids wrote letters, and one girl wrote a letter to then nominee Trump. And she said, all right, you're going to put the date on this, and we're going to make a copy, and you can send one, but we're going to keep one here because what you're doing is history. And I think, do we have the third example? Yeah, this was a third grade class in Oakland. And when we were done giving our presentation, the teacher and the kids said, we want to show you something. And they led us from the auditorium to their classroom. And this was the day after the election. She said the kids were so distraught about the result that she had them create these pictures of people speaking up for what they believe in. So they wanted to show us the art that they had made. So as much as it's a very difficult time, getting to see all of these amazing educators and young people who are already speaking up has been a really powerful part of sharing this story.
It's been very inspiring for us to see a young generation really taking action for what they believe in. And we end all of our presentations with this question for students: how can you be like Fred and speak up for what you think is right? And we hope that the students will think of this question not just the day we do the presentation, but you know, the next week, the next month, the next year, the next 10 years. And we close by saying that regardless of whether you're 10 or whether you're 100, you really can make a difference if you stand up for what you believe in. So that is our school presentation.
Our formal presentation.
We would love to hear your answers to this question and to hear your questions to us about Fred Korematsu, about the World War II incarceration, about writing the book. So thank you. Thank you, Angela.
Thank you so much. I am curious as to how you landed on... So I have a couple questions. Do you have a curriculum guide? And how did you land on fourth and fifth graders? Because I created a presentation that I made for older students based on some writings that my mother did. She was also a Topaz.
Mm-hmm.
And then she'd written as an older person talking about her experience, and then I also uncovered some journal writings where she was reflecting on her high school experience.
Wow.
And I created something for older middle schoolers and as well as high schoolers because I thought that the material was almost too strong for younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you made it come across, it was very appropriate for them. So I was just curious how you decided on fourth to fifth, because it's a very particular age.
Mm-hmm.
They're not jaded yet. even in New York, they're not jaded yet. And what you did to make the material appropriate for them.
Okay. So do we need to repeat the question,
yeah,
Anthony, for the...
Okay.
So in terms of deciding on fourth and fifth grade... Fourth grade in California is the year in which students study California history or state history. So I don't know if that's the case in New York or not. So there was sort of a natural, or what we thought would be a natural opening for use in classrooms, even though fourth grade California history curriculum really just focuses on early Native communities and then the Gold Rush. So it doesn't get to World War II. Right, because you grew up in Yes. So that's how that focus was initially decided upon. But then when we were doing sort of not focus group,
we did a focus group with fourth graders. And actually, I think the truth is the book is being used, or at least who we're speaking to, is mostly fifth to eighth grade.
Yeah.
Like, it's landed a little bit older. And I think the book itself, you know, though we have had younger, we talked to kindergartners at one school, who actually paid attention, which was great.
Yeah, who knows how much they absorbed and understood.
Yeah. But we did have one librarian who worked with elementary school kids who said to us when she heard about the book, she said, that's great that you're thinking of writing for fourth grade, but she said it would be really great if you could even write it below that in terms of the reading level, because so many of the students that she has don't read at grade level. And we've been told that by a lot of teachers. Like, we went to a middle school in Oakland where we're pretty sure our memory was that she said that all of the students there were reading at three or four
grades. I think it's actually an entire Oakland school district.
Was that what
I think
3 or 4 years below grade level?
What?
Which, so don't quote us because we may be getting the statistics wrong. But so that was part of the decision to write the free verse biography and then have these more kind of dense sections with historical information and images so that kids who are maybe not reading at grade level can still access the content. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's turned out is that actually the book has a fair amount of flexibility. What probably levels it the most are the definitions, I think, because what words we're defining would probably imply some expectation of what the students would comprehend or not. But yeah, it seems to be, as we talked to one ninth grade class, but mostly it's been fifth to eighth.
And you also ask about curriculum. Mm-hmm. So on the Fighting for Justice series website, there is a lesson plan that a fifth grade teacher in Oakland put together based on our book. So look for that.
That's
on the school
fantastic.
Visit section.
Yeah, it's in the school visit section. And then there's I put the website together. It's WordPress. It's not particularly gorgeous. But so you might have to find it. But there's a link to the curriculum there. And it's great. She's got it in four different sections. And there's links to lots of videos and interviews. So she's really kind of broadened out from this story. And there's a lot of great material. Yeah.
I think it would be good for you to think about extending your stay in New York for a couple of days. Because I think there are several groups that you need to talk to. One is the teachers' union, which, as you know, there's no curriculum in New York City for the camps or Japanese in general or Fred Korematsu, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But this past year, the city council voted to have Fred Korematsu Day, but none of the teachers' college professors, nobody knows about Fred Korematsu.
Right.
And so we have some major teachers' colleges here, Teachers College of Columbia, that has those documents, and they shouldn't. And Hunter and NYU, and you know, I think you really need to talk to the people who are teaching the curriculum because they don't know anything about it. And then the head of the New York City school system is a brand new chancellor, and you need to meet with him to make sure that nothing happens in New York without, you know, a lot of fuss. So you can't just assume that giving one teacher a copy of the book is going to do anything except for that one teacher and the kids. So I think you ought to stay a little longer, and some of us could help you get appointments, like with the city council. You ought to talk to UFT. It was Fred's daughter who talked to UFT, and Danny Drum, the city council person, heard her. And because he heard her, then he, for 2 years, fought with the city council, and they finally passed that legislation. But I think, you know, there's a lot of groundwork that you could do at a higher level than the fourth graders.
Probably.
Because that would have a much more systemic effect on what happens in New York City.
So we would, first of all, we would love to do that. Second of all, since we are returning in October, if we can arrange for some of those meetings to take place then, because I think 2 days from now is going to be.
In October, you know, you could, there's time now to set some appointments so they
I see.
Too busy.
Okay.
Our
right. Got
set.
It.
That's a favorite answer. So,
okay.
You know, you've got to plan ahead.
Right.
Some of these books.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds like you may be able to help.
So we should talk afterwards to try to pin down
specific
people and. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And we have included in our New York City presentations a slide of Karen Korematsu with David Drum and Margaret Chin and Peter Koo. Is that his last? Who were instrumental in helping the New York City Council to pass that ordinance or legislation, whatever.
Yeah, and we're happy to keep coming back.
I just wanted to jump off what Suki just brought up. I'm also from California, from Oakland, and I have two sisters who are Oakland Unified School District teachers.
Oh, really?
But I think the Korematsu question is actually a very important portal at this particular time, not just in terms of young people, but also I felt that in terms of whether or not the question of dumbing down, if I can just use that term, no offense intended, is that I think a lot of people, particularly even young people, are quite aware in terms of how the shift that political climate is, and they would be very understanding in terms of what the issues that we need to present to them. Mm-hmm. With that said, I also think that it's not enough in terms of just getting some politicians to pass a resolution in city council to say, yeah, we're going to have Fred Korematsu Day, mm-hmm. which is nice and dandy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go anywhere in terms of content.
Mm-hmm.
The content has to dig in deeper. And part of it is not, well, one is the people, the Japanese American community in New York City is very minute compared mm-hmm. to the West Coast, mm-hmm. where we're from. So we need to do some aggressive outreach in conjunction not only with the school system, with any interested politician, mm-hmm. and I leave like that, but also need to dig into some of these nonprofit organizations mm-hmm. because it behooves them in terms of the changing political climate, not just in terms of funding. It behooves them to actually take this question up in a much more aggressive way. Because I work for a major nonprofit, and they're moving in a certain direction, but there needs to be a higher leap by some of these nonprofit organizations that are serving the community beyond just social services. And especially with the influx of so many new Asian immigrants coming in, they are actually not, informed mm-hmm. about what's going on. They take a lot of things for granted in terms of what this country allegedly provides to them, mm-hmm. to you and I, or whatever. Because it's a question of, one, there's a lot of history has passed in terms of the civil rights movement, the Black Liberation Struggle, the Asian American Radical Movement, how that actually informed, where we are at today, and how the extreme right is responding backwards on that question. So, I think there's a lot at stake, and I think we need to actually get into more discussion about how we can do that, because one thing that's critically needed is that we need to build a culture of resistance. And I'll take off my nonprofit ministry just happen to speak as a political activist, is that that is not enough to be found right now in this environment. Okay, so much of us live in New York City. We live in a bubble. Okay, and now once in a while you might hear a really vocal Trump supporter, but also they're also trying to change the climate overall. Some of these alt-right people are actually making inroads into Berkeley, of all places. And so I just leave it like that. But I think the culture resistance has to raise, and this is a very important tool for that. But also it's for other people in the room. I think it's a very important portal that we need to take advantage of and build from.
Thank you.
I totally hear what you're saying, and we should all talk together and see what we can do. I just wanted to see if you could elaborate more on the creative process and your collaboration and how you bounce ideas off each other, how you engage the illustrator. And I think it's beautifully presented. I can't wait to actually get the book and really get a good look at it.
Thank you.
Let's see if this reacts. We actually have slides that help.
Okay.
This one. we forgot.
we use so many different PowerPoints that we kind of lose track of which ones we're using. So let me rewind a bit and explain that this book is the first in a series. And the series came about because I had co-written another book for the same publisher, Heyday, which is a Berkeley-based small press.
No.
And that book was on the history of civil rights in California. And Fred Korematsu's story was central to that book. And it was published almost 10 years ago, 2009. And the publisher, after that first book, which is called Wherever There's a Fight, came out, said, let's do a children's version of the Civil Liberties History book. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. And I raised my hand and said, I want to work on that. And I had never written for children before. And with a mixture of hubris and naivete, I thought, how hard could it be to write for a 10-year-old? So believe me, it's for me at least, it was pretty hard. And since I didn't have any experience or knowledge of that children's book world, I just sort of checked out books that were marketed for 9 or 10-year-olds, which was a totally futile exercise because the range of books that are marketed to that age group is, like, vast. And it could be a picture book with 5 words on a page or Harry Potter, right, more sophisticated. So I just sort of thought, okay, well, I'm going to write this biography of Fred, and I was kind of fumbling around and writing, and the publisher was not happy with the drafts. And so finally he said, let's bring in a children's book writer who knows the world and knows how to communicate to kids. So that's how Laura came into the picture. I'll pass the baton to continue the story.
So my background is that I've been a children's book editor for a long time, as the introduction said. So I was at Children's Book Press, which was a nonprofit publisher of multicultural and bilingual picture books in San Francisco, and then ultimately an editor for 2 years at Lee & Low Books, which is a publisher of multicultural picture books. And then I left traditional publishing, moved to England for a while, went into academia, and became a freelance children's book editor. So in 2015, I was in San Francisco speaking on a panel that was at the San Francisco Public Library, and the panel was on diversity in children's publishing. And the editor from Heyday was in the audience. And actually, at the time, I was also working on an MFA in children's publishing with Tom, my colleague in the corner over there, at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and it was an MFA in writing for children and young adults. So I was sort of at a cusp moment because I'd been an editor for all these years, and I was finally saying, oh, maybe I could try to write, maybe. And so Molly Woodward, the editor from Heyday, who had been working with Stan, came up after and asked at first if I would come on as a developmental editor. And then ultimately, Stan and I worked together. We had a focus group with fourth graders. And then they asked me to pitch to be a co-writer. And at that point, Stan had been writing it as sort of more of a traditional prose biography. And so that's when I pitched the idea of the format. The idea of the poem partially being that it would be more accessible to younger readers. Also that it really engenders empathy, because it's really like you're walking in his shoes. And it allowed us to take out the, like, what's the ACLU? Or how do you define discrimination? Or when did the, you know, this thing happen in history? But we still tried to keep it very visual and interesting looking, so that it doesn't feel like, oh, this is some stuffy history book. And you may have seen we have questions that we include in all of those sort of more dense, rich sections to get kids to reflect on their own lives and the issues that were happening in the book. So then we worked together. Stan really took the lead on the historical. I mean, as you can see, he's the historian. When I heard he almost didn't make it because of the storm. And so I ended up putting the date for the bombing of Pearl Harbor on that slide, because I just don't hold those things in my head, whereas with Stan, you know, has all of that. And I took the lead on the poems for this book.
And we had Google Docs, and so we would sort of edit each other's works. And so it was a pretty intense process for, what, six?
It was not that long. It was like 4 months even of concentrated by the time. But since you'd done all the research and we'd worked together, mm-hmm. And Molly was really involved too, the editor. She mm-hmm. was a major piece of it. Mm-hmm. So it was quite intense.
You mentioned Laurie. How about Karen? How is she involved in...
Yes, so we interviewed Karen and Ken, Karen's brother, and Karen, who runs the Korematsu Institute, which if you don't know about the Korematsu Institute, you should know about, especially if you're educators, because they provide free resources, including this documentary of civil wrongs and rights from which that clip in our presentation was taken. I believe they provide a copy of Laurie's book, Enduring Conviction, and ours as well.
Yeah, but an excerpt of ours.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, an excerpt of ours. Mm-hmm. So Karen has been very, very supportive of this effort.
She's coming here too.
Oh, good.
Wow.
She's fantastic.
I want to make a comment on the children's book. And I've been very, very active in redress reparations and you all about Cora Novus, but I think you did an amazing job of making it more informative for somebody like me.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was really informative.
Really?
And
well,
the way
thank you
phrased it and the way you talked about it, you know, I was just really stunned
wow.
at how much I didn't know. And you also made Fred Korematsu much more likable than my memory.
Oh, really?
We gave him a makeup.
Because when we saw him or met him, he was with Min Yasui and Gordon Hirabayashi, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and he was the choir director.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
And Min Yasui was like this amazing
garrulous,
friend.
Yeah.
And so you just changed, even though I've heard Karen speak a couple of times, you've really made my mindset very different towards
wow.
him.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's very meaningful.
I wanted to just engage with this gentleman in the back a little mm-hmm. bit about education, because I do agree that the time is ripe and Ryuzuki is hounding us all to do more. But I also want to say what's great about targeting fourth and fifth graders and then older middle schoolers and then high schoolers and then college kids is that learning is a spiral. And so what you learn when you're a little kid, I mean, I can look at my own almost 21-year-old, and I've been ranting and raving about this since she could talk. She gets it now. We actually are supposedly getting a couple of tattoos that are going to say topaz with an O. She's still designing.
Wow.
I never thought I would get a tattoo, but I said, you know, she wants to go for it. Let's try it. Why not? But I think the point is that you hear it and you get it one way when you're 4 and 5. You're like, what would you do? What would you pack in your suitcase? You know, there's an exhibit downtown about, you know, you're an immigrant. You have to take a suitcase on the ship. What do you pack? And so they have goofy things in like a giant teddy bear and then a few clothes, a pair of shoes, and then you see how long that'll last. But it's great that you put that in there because kids latch onto it. So it's... You know, when I did it for the high school kids, I really wanted them to feel what it'd be like to be a high school kid, to have your friends, as one of the many movies that I've seen with the survivor tell the story, that his, you know, one day he's playing ball with his friends in the field, I mean in the empty lot, and then Pearl Harbor is bombed, and the next day his friends are throwing rocks at him. And that was like high school kid gets what that feels like. You know, some of us have had that experience. And but that's too much for our fourth and fifth grader to hear, right? So we need it at those different portals where we can jump in and, you know, putting the kid in the story is such a wonderful mechanism to make that happen.
Yeah. We spoke at a school in Walnut Creek, so those of you from the Bay Area know where that is. And
all the kids read the book. It was a middle school, right? Over the summer, they all read the book.
And one of the assignments that the teacher gave to them before, the students before we came to speak, was go home, you know, pack a bag as if you're going to have to leave your home, take the bag outside, put it in your trunk, and then journal about it or write about it. And the teacher was saying that she got the most amazing responses because kids had never really thought about it at that level and doing the physical act of having to pack the bag and take it out of the house, right? And they never really appreciated, she said, the sense of home and what that meant. Mm-hmm.
And I think we noticed, like, so now having been in at a few New York schools, now that we present a lot in California, and I think the schools we're going to, the kids to some extent have learned about it, but I've just been aware of feeling a different sense of the kids, like, what? You know, like, wait, what? And partially maybe because I think we really make an effort to make it very immediate. So it's not this abstract. It's like, okay, they went into orphanages. You know, when you really get down to, but I've been feeling that more here, maybe because, and we're out of our element.
Where were the schools you went to here in New York?
One was Manhattan Country School, where Akemi Kochiyama works. Today we were at Hastings on Hudson. We spoke to fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday morning, we were at IS 89 in Battery Park. And then Monday, we'll be at Bank Street.
Talking to eighth graders.
Did you just put
the word out. So we did the same thing. We went to Seattle. And we came here because of this event. So in Seattle, we went to the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle. And so we knew that would be the hardest date to kind of fix. So once we got in their calendar, then we just, and Stan and I have a nice sort of like, you know, these concentric circles where they're like overlap a little bit, but have very different communities that we engage with. So I'm more children's book world and you're Asian American, ACLU, activist world. And so we just put the word out to everyone we know. And then, I mean, and we do ask people to pay because Heyday, our publisher, is a small nonprofit publisher in Berkeley that really doesn't even do children's books very much. So we're self-funding for all of this. So we end up having to say to schools, can we come and can you pay us? So it's a little, you know, tricky. But we had actually two fantastic school visits in Seattle that came out of that. And then all of the ones here have come out of that, too.
Bank Street Day.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they're all paying. Yeah.
Well, but you need to really find out how many teachers at Bank Street know about what you're going to be talking about. I'll bet it'll be zero or very, very, very few.
Yeah, we've connected with Allie Jane Bruce, who's their librarian. So she's the one who, the person I knew who's bringing us there.
Do you have plans to move, like, from the coast more inland? Because I feel like, I mean, I'm from California, and so I feel like the proximity to the history of the camps, like, makes people more aware of it. But especially, like, as you move inland and as revisionist history infiltrates the schools, I wonder if that's in your plan in terms of the map of where you're going.
No. It's a short answer.
Yes.
Because, you know, since we are doing this on our own, our publisher can't afford to send us on a tour.
Okay.
It's kind of opportunistic, basically.
Right.
So luckily for us, we were able to accept the New York Historical Society's award because they scheduled the presentation when we were here in town. The book was also given an award by the National Council for the Social Studies, which is a professional group for social studies teachers. And theoretically, at least, because we've only heard this via their website, not from them officially. So National Council of Social Studies teachers, if you see this video, please let us know officially that we've received this award. So they're theoretically going to present that to us in Chicago in November. So we're going to try to arrange some school visits in Chicago.
There we go. And that's the Carter G. Woodson Award, which is an award for an ethnic-themed social studies book. And we got the older readers... award. So that helps. That helps to get the word out. I mean, I think, you know, if someone comes to us and says, we want to, you know, there is actually in San Diego, we were contacted by a community college that works with a lot of...
English language learners, and so they've asked us to speak at one of their book fair days.
But they're having us for 2 days, so they're having us do four different events, and they just bought a bunch of the copies of the book. So the book has, I mean, for Heyday, small publisher, first print run 3,000 copies. They are now, we just heard, printing another 12,000, fifth printing. Right. So there are 26,000 copies in print, which for, you know. and the ACLU of Northern California has been incredibly supportive. So they have given it away at awards and are really telling people about it. They're trying to get it into the hands of all the librarians in the state. Abdi Sultani, their executive director, has just been an incredible kind of ambassador.
So if you know of anybody in the middle of the country that would be interested in having us...
Yeah, I'm not in the education space, so I don't know how much, like, how any of these processes work.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, I have friends who are in the education space, at least in Texas. But I'm wondering, and I don't know how great feelings are about Teach for America, but I know Teach for America tends to, like put seeds out of different teachers all around the country. So I'm wondering if that's a potential avenue, and for those who are in the education space, if that's like a viable one or an ethical one to go through.
I mean, schools just don't seem to have money. I mean, that's one of the issues. It's like when, you know, we did get a grant through the Civil Liberties...
California Civil Liberties Public Education Program, which is run through the California State Library, and they award grants through this program for projects that help educate Californians about the World War II incarceration.
And so we were able to offer visits in Oakland because Oakland schools are horribly underfunded. Most of them don't have libraries. The ones that do have libraries are the ones that have active PTAs with more affluent families. I mean, it's just the inequity is horrible. They have a great head of the school libraries, and she worked with us to get us into the schools that I think we went to at least one where we were the first ever school visit they'd ever had. And a lot of the schools classes we've been speaking to are majority Latino. And there are all sorts of ways that this overlaps. We had one girl afterwards tell us that her father had been deported. So the ways that this story connects to the experiences of the, you know. So it's, but the schools just don't have money, you know. And when then I think we're relatively affordable for two of us, but it's still for the school feels like, you know, it's a big ask.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's where the National Association of Independent Schools could step up to the plate and... We talk about equity, right? So equity is if you can afford it. If you're a private school and you can afford to designate the money to do this, or even if you're an affluent public school, which we have those in New York City, Tribeca, Park Slope, where right near I live, you know, it's like those PTA, those parent associations, they raise major cash. Hundreds of thousands, almost $1 million.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. I mean, they fund full positions in the schools. And you know, supplies out the wazoo. But the question of equity comes to mind, and it might be something where someone could make up a proposal where, you know, somehow we get you matched mm-hmm. to them, and they agree to fund, you know, an underserved mm-hmm. school in particular. I mean, I think, you know, New York City, because mm-hmm. we know which of our zip codes are vulnerable.
Yeah, the ones that don't have soap or paper towels or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a understanding that all humans are fairly much the same when it comes to morality, and we all have an agreement on what is right and what is wrong. Sorry, I have an allergy. What is right and what is wrong until we're afraid. And then from within a place of fear, that is all abandoned. Mm. So I think it's so brilliant that you're looking at Fred Karametsu, because the fear is now removed, so it can be universally recognized as an injustice. But how do you equate that if you're going into a place where people have present day fears? Mm. If you went into Middle America, these kids' parents could be very afraid of immigrants, very afraid of Muslims, very afraid of Black Lives Matter. So as part of your curriculum, you have a thought on short-circuiting that fear problem. If you went into a school, those kids, their parents are very afraid of present-day problems.
Yeah.
And the shorter answer is no, we don't have a strategy for that. Because to be honest, you know, the schools that we've been invited to, it's been a self-selecting group, right?
Yeah.
So it's usually progressive teachers or administrators, right?
Right.
Yeah.
If I may, I just want to throw something in, just for a thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a teacher, but I recently had a conversation which actually was based on Steven Spielberg's movie Schindler's List, and that back in the late 90s when the movie came out, there's a point to it, I think, which I make, is that they showed it to some high school students in Oakland. And there maybe was an African American school, I can't remember which one.
Castlemont.
Castlemont.
Which is in West Oakland.
I think you're right.
We're
thinking Castlemont.
Castlemont.
Which is where Fred Karametsu went.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's why they did it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so they had a special showing of Schindler's List. And a lot of the kids were giggling at some very, very sensitive parts of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And New York Times did an article on that. That prompted Spielberg to have a sit down with some of the students to find out what was going on. My point here is there's a gap in terms of what people's understanding is. And even people who are considered the oppressed, there's no understanding of some of these larger issues. And in other words, we just can't be waiting for somebody to come and sort of like present it to them from within. It has to come from without. And the other thing is that I totally agree. We have to go deeper. Can't just go to, I'm not saying that you have to do it. There's a responsibility for people here in this room and beyond, because if we think that this is a gap, it's a problem that we need to address, that by God we need to address it in a real way. Because if African-American students cannot see the connection between what happened to Jewish people in Nazi Germany, then there's a problem there, you know. If other nationalities, whether they're Arab and Muslim, can't see that connection in terms of what happened to Japanese Americans, or even Chinese immigrants. Now, I work for a social service agency, the largest Asian American serving organization
in the United States.
Wow.
And there's a gap there. There's a huge gap. Mm-hmm. Okay? And there's a lot of Trump supporters who are misguided, and some of them are because, you know, they bought into
history.
Their Kool-Aid.
There's a Chinese organization and Japanese organization. This is historic. This doesn't happen in New York City all the time, if ever. I mean, rarely. So tonight, if you were saying history.
Wow.
I'm talking about the Bay Area, so it's total intermarriage between Chinese and Japanese and wherever.
Literally.
And my wife is Sansei. So, and I went to school with Dan Tamaki, okay? Or Dan Tamaki with them. My point is basically we really have to get beyond just going to these more privileged schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to denigrate them, because some of these folks have very open minds.
Mm-hmm.
but also are we dealing with these other issues that, you know, on the bottom of society that we need to find out about this?
Amen. And thank you again for joining us tonight and for this great conversation.
Yeah, this has been wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.